86. Sunday and Monday, sunny and 89 both days. Currently, 64 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha under a sunny sky. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have three interviews for you today, beginning with an interview with two emergency room doctors talking about their new book, Microskills. Also, an interview from the morning show archives from 2020 with Marlo Thomas and Phil Donahue talking about their book, What Makes a Marriage Last. We'll be replaying that interview today in memory of Phil Donahue, who passed away yesterday. Here's part one of today's program. In this portion of WGTD's morning show, we're going to be talking about something that my guests call microskills. And this is a way in which we can, in a sense, build better habits for our lives in terms of our personal lives, our professional lives as well. And sometimes we tend to think about sort of the big picture facets of life that we need to really work on and improve. And sometimes maybe the most effective way to think about those things is in a sense in smaller ways, in smaller pieces, as microskills. And that is what is explored in a really interesting new book called Microskills, Small Actions, Big Impact. It is the work of two emergency medicine physicians, Dr. Adara Landry, an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School and an emergency medicine physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and Dr. Risa Lewis, a professor of emergency medicine at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. And the two of them have joined together to talk about some of the ways in which, especially in our professional lives, but in our personal lives certainly as well, it might be very helpful to think about smaller building blocks in terms of us being the people we want to be and living the kind of life that we want to live. And I'm glad we can have a few minutes to talk about this interesting book published by HarperCollins, again titled Microskills, Small Actions, Big Impact. Dr. Adara Landry, Dr. Risa Lewis, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thanks so much for having us. Wonderful to be here.
So I'm intrigued by the fact that this book comes from two people who are emergency medicine physicians, probably not with a whole lot of free time on your hands. And I mean, I think the expectation probably would be if somebody took this book off the shelf that it might be from somebody who's in the realm of management, perhaps. But you have been moved to write this book. What prompted it? What prompted your interest in this and maybe your understanding of how our lives are actually put together with these so-called microskills?
I'll start. First, thank you so much for the opportunity to be here. We started actually by writing articles together that were actually not traditionally in the academic publication arena. So usually doctors you would see us publishing in journal outlets that are specific to our field of practice. Risa and I came together because we were finding that some of the personal, professional, collaborative experiences that we were having in the workplace really weren't specific to just doctors. They were relevant to all, like how to write a letter of recommendation for yourself, how to be compassionate with your email practices, how to use Twitter to build a network. Those aren't specific to just being a physician. And so we started writing for larger audiences like Harvard Business Review and CNBC and Fast Company. And I think after sort of that proof of concept that, hey, we are onto something and people were interested in what we had to say, a book just sort of seemed like a next natural step. To your comment about, yes, these books are traditionally from those C-suite executives, you know, in consulting, in the startup world, et cetera. But honestly, working in a hospital is very similar to any other industry. You know, we have supervisors, we have colleagues, we don't necessarily have customers or a like physical product, but we have patients and we have, you know, something that we offer them, a service that we offer them. So we deal with a lot of the same issues in regards to communication and conflict and self-care and building a brand. It's all similar. And so we really wanted to bring that in, and we wanted it to be from doctors. And I'll let Risa add more. I'm sure she has more to say about our journey.
Hmm. Agree with everything. And when you read this book, you can tell, and a colleague moderator at one of our talks gave us the hugest compliment. She said, you can tell this is written by educators. And I think that's the piece about this book. We're not just physicians, we're both subject matter experts, studied educators, and just educators in particular at the bedside, the concept of just-in-time learning and just-in-time teaching. And that's what we do in this book. You really gave an excellent definition of a microskill, a fundamental building block, specifically when you're feeling overwhelmed by a large project, a large goal, a large task, a character trait or a habit that you're looking to work into your work life or home life. And we really think that virtually everything can be approached by breaking it down into these small steps. And when we did a survey of the business self-help books and articles, we found many just say, go out and do it, but they don't actually break it down into critical actions and steps of how. We start the book with three fundamental truths. And one is that time can only be spent. The two that are really relevant of this concept of access is that the world is not equal. We all start in different places in the workplace, networks, pedigrees, resources, finances. And we really wanted to use these micro skills to level set so that we may not all start at the same place, but we'd really love it if everybody ends at the same place.
Hmm. Let's talk for a moment about the mix of professional and personal. I mean, I think it's fair to say that this book dwells mostly in the professional arena, and yet clearly many of these micro skills have an impact on one's personal life. And of course, it's fair to say that one can't really have a successful professional life if your personal life is a mess. So it's clear that many of these micro skills, in a sense, work in tandem or really do affect kind of both of those arenas. How complicated was that as you were writing the book and thinking about these micro skills in terms of making sense of the professional and or the personal?
I don't think it was difficult for us at all. We firmly believe that everything starts with the self. And the more you take care of yourself and your health, which we broadly define, sure, physical health, but we're talking mental health, social health, financial health, etc., the better you are to show up for your team and ultimately to deliver a high-quality work product. So we've been asked this question because I think many of us traditionally think work is work, but home is home. We really think there's a fluidity. And you're absolutely right. One example I'll bring up is this concept of the personal board of directors, which we didn't come up with a concept, but we love the concept. And these are your go-to people, people you trust that have your best interest in mind that are trying to help you succeed and, for example, get promoted in the workplace. The people that you call when you have financial questions. Then you have someone else that you may call when something's going on in your personal relationships. Someone, you know, what do you do with your aging parents? Someone, how do you get invited to be a keynote speaker? this concept of the table and all these different people that you speak with, these people sitting at your table, it's not literally a table, but it's this concept of your go-to people that you keep with you. Some come and go. There are no term limits. And also, these aren't simple transactional one-way relationships. These go two ways. So that, again, covers both personal and professional.
I'll add that in the book, we have numerous personal anecdotes that really bring our journey into the book. So this isn't a book full of, you know, hypothetical case studies or like anonymous personal anecdotes. Like, we bring in things that happen to us that are real. And there's a lot of overlap between what happened in the professional arena and how that affected us personally, you know, as humans, as educators, as physicians, as colleagues. I'll give a quick example of how the Venn diagram is actually quite heavily overlapped between personal and professional strategies. When during COVID, I was invited to give a panel, to be on a panel. It was going to be at 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock in the evening. At the time, I had a 3-year-old and a 2-year-old, or around that age, young children. And I live in Boston, and so I remember setting up for this panel in the evening, and it was like smack in the middle of dinner time, bedtime rituals. And I closed the door to start this panel and just sort of like lock myself out of the house, or out of the, you know, the living space. And my kids, you know, they were trying to come into the room and disrupt everything. And so I actually ended up like pushing a dresser against the door to like barricade them. And I gave this panel, which, by the way, the topic was work-life balance. And so I'm sitting there, I kid you not, setting up for this panel, listening to my kids banging on the door, just asking for mama, mama. And the first question that's asked to me by the moderator is, Dr. Landry, do you mind just explaining how you're able to balance work and life for us? And I'm sitting there thinking like, wow, this is not it. And I made a personal decision to not do meetings from 6 to 9 p.m. because it just doesn't work when you have young kids. Not for me, not for my household. It didn't work. So that was a personal decision that had a professional consequence, which is that I didn't do those activities. But it made me so much happier about my job because I wasn't resentful. And I came back to work the next morning and I was like refreshed and less stressed out. So even though I had perhaps less professional opportunities in the evening, I felt like I was just more energized to work during the daytime.
So I think that would be an example of the micro skill of creating boundaries.
Yes.
And or... and or quitting opportunities. Yes. There are a couple of those, but that also reminds us that some of these overlap. They are not each self-contained entities, but I suppose the more you start thinking about your life in this way, the more these micro skills, in a sense, just sort of present themselves to us.
Yeah. I'm really glad you brought up this concept of JOMO, joy of missing out. Many audience members are familiar with FOMO, fear of missing out, and that fear is put into us, many industries, and certainly when we are young professionals. You know, you want to say yes to every opportunity. That might be your big break. That might get you, and so on and so on. We really talk about the concept of the joy of missing out, taking things off your plate so that you can focus, setting those boundaries. And I fully subscribe to the say yes to everything. And then I started reading and speaking more and thinking more about myself and taking care of myself first, then the team, then the work. And initially, it became very uncomfortable to say no to things or to quit things. Seth Godin famously has a book called The Dip, and he talks about quitting things on a regular basis. So I started seeing how that felt. And initially, discomfort, uncomfortable. And then it became sort of a habit, and you get really good at it. And by getting really good at that, you really fine-tune so that what is on your plate, your task list, really brings joy, really are those items on which you want to work.
One thing I appreciate about the book is that it is written with a nice combination of assurance and humility. And I appreciate the openness with which you talk about both the things that have been, in a sense, stunning successes for you, and then areas of your life, either professionally or personally, in which it's been a bit of a struggle. I wonder, for each of you, would there be an example of a micro skill that has not come naturally to you, that you really had to work extra hard in order to really achieve and embrace?
I'll start by saying we definitely wanted to approach the reader in a way that felt accessible. We did not want the book to just be about how we have achieved many different things, because that would be a false narrative of, you know, all of the things that are hidden and more obscure when you're meeting someone who just like appears successful. And so that was very important to us. In regards to a skill that I think, even for me today, I feel like I'm better at it, but I'm always working on it. It's one of our last micro skills, and that's pausing before you accept an opportunity. I'm an advisor for the Harvard Medical School, and so I meet a lot of students regularly who come to me, and it's very clear that they're overwhelmed by their plates. They just have too much on their plate, and that overwhelm leads to burnout and or depression, or feeling like they are a failure because they can't complete their work. And by just making the change of not impulsively accepting something that comes your way, you can sort of create that. Again, sort of goes back to boundaries. I love boundaries, as you can see, but it creates this sort of buffer so that you have some time. So the micro skill is pausing before you accept an opportunity. And it really was born out of this idea that I was fed, and I think Risa, Dr. Lewis was fed this too, which is say yes to everything, especially when you're early in your career, because you never know what you're going to miss out on. And it really ties back to this idea of FOMO. And so you think, I need to say yes, because what if this is the opportunity that, you know, catapults my career? What if I say no and now this person doesn't want to work with me anymore? How will this hurt my reputation if I decline, right? All these things make you feel like I need to say yes. And what we really want people to do is just to pause and ask questions up front to really see if it's a good opportunity for you. And it's as simple as asking, you know, questions like, is there funding? Will this be funded? Do I have admin support? When is this due? You know, can I have an extension because I have something else coming up right now? Who am I working with? Just asking those questions allows you to really see if something is a good opportunity for you or not the right fit. And you can say yes, you can say no, you can say not right now, you can say yes, but I also need this. All of these things can happen. The idea is just to move away from this impulsive yes. And then months later, weeks later, days later, you're like, oh my God, why did I say yes to this thing? I didn't even know. I didn't even realize how much work it was going to be.
The one I'll bring up is feedback. And feedback can be soliciting, asking for feedback, but also giving feedback. And these, both of these are something on which I've worked. So I tell a story in the book about giving feedback. I had attended a faculty meeting. They were speaking about a trainee. And it just so happened soon thereafter, I was working with that trainee. And I thought, okay, now's the time I'm going to give feedback as a reflection of what was discussed in the meeting. And we started shift, and I started with, okay, the focus for today is focus. Because based on the discussion in the meeting, the trainee really was working on and not so organized in patient care. However, the way I delivered the feedback, it came out of nowhere. I did not prepare. I describe it as, quote, an epic fail. All the ways that I could have done so much better in providing feedback. And so I learned. And in terms of soliciting feedback, there are so many books written on feedback alone. The one I like is The Just One Thing. You know, I will give a lecture, give a slide presentation, etc. And people are like, that was great. And a part of me is like, do they really think it's great? Or are they just saying that to be nice? But one way to really get feedback, and also I think to see if they're just being nice or they're for real, is to say, what's one thing? Is there just one thing that stood out? Is there just one story you think I should make sure I use the next time I provide this presentation? Or what's one thing that you would like to see me do next time that I didn't do this time? And one thing is very quite sizable, and usually people can come up with that just one thing.
I love that. I want to give you a chance to talk for a moment about what you like to call compassionate email practice. And you spend enough time on this in the book that it's obviously something you feel has real significance, and I agree. And, of course, email is can be a blessing and also the bane of our existence, depending on whether or not it's misused. What would be a couple of suggestions you have in terms of being more thoughtful and mindful in how we utilize email, particularly in the professional environment?
I'll start and say that we wrote this article because we felt that we both have put a lot of energy into adjusting our inboxes by, you know, unsubscribing from newsletters, for instance, or trying to reach this idea of like inbox zero, where you're like getting through your inbox every night. And no matter how much energy I was putting into managing my inbox, I just felt like I was still getting these emails at all hours of the night that were really, really long, that had 1,000 people on the to line, and now I'm in this like reply all vortex. And so we wanted to write an article that really wasn't focused on taking care of the inbox to benefit you, but rather to take care of the inbox in a way that benefits others. Because if we're thinking about sending an email to other people, we can be more thoughtful on like, is this actually disrupting their personal time? Is this going to result in like 1,000 people replying all and not everyone needing to know all the details in that chain, right? And so just really thinking about the other person and who's receiving this email. I'll let Risa give some examples because she's great at explaining these.
Well, what we love is, in terms of feedback and reflection on the book, a lot of people say, oh, I didn't think I was going to learn anything. I've been in the workforce 40 years. I'm already 60. I'm already 70. The one consistent micro skill that people provide us feedback on and say, gosh, I really learned is on email and email etiquette, because we all think we're really good at it. We have to do it. It's part of every workplace culture. So in this concept of compassionate email, it's about when you send. That's one aspect. I used to send, we're emergency doctors, send emails all hours. We're working all hours. It doesn't matter. And in my mind, people will know that they don't need to respond right away. They'll read the message. They'll understand the urgency or lack of urgency and respond when they wish. I was working as the leader of a team, and one of the team members said to me, you know, Risa, when you send me an email on Saturday, I get really stressed. I know I don't have to respond, but I end up feeling like I do. And so that really was appreciated feedback to me, that I can write my email. I can, though, schedule send it. And that's one of the micro skills that Aaron and I speak about, is schedule the send. Essentially, every email software allows you to schedule it. And really, if something is that urgent, emergent, that it can't wait, you need to pick up the phone or you need to send a text. Email's probably not the best means of communication. And we have a whole chapter on polished communication. So that is one, specifically the schedule send. The other thing I'll say is we have a whole build out of ways to use the BCC. Say you want to introduce a mentee to a new mentor. You can write that email to the mentor and the mentee. When the mentee responds, they can keep the new mentor in the to line, move me, the original mentor, in the BCC line. Therefore, I can see that the mentee picks up the communication, but I've been removed from the thread and don't need to continue on that communication.
That really was a great part of the book for me. I mean, I enjoyed the whole book, though, however, start to finish. And my desk is piled high with comparable books, but I feel like this is one of the best that I have read in a long, long time in terms of really being tangible and thoughtfully put together with all kinds of really potentially beneficial suggestions on just improving the way we live and interact with one another and the world. The book is, again, Micro Skills, Small Actions, Big Impact, published by HarperCollins. And the authors, Dr. Adara Landry and Dr. Risa Lewis. Thank you so much for taking time out of what I know are busy schedules to be my morning show guest today. It was wonderful to speak with you, and wish you well.
Thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Yesterday, the world lost Phil Donahue, pioneering daytime talk show host, at the age of 88. I had the opportunity back in 2020 of recording a brief interview with Phil Donahue and his wife, actress Marlo Thomas, talking about their newly published book called What Makes a Marriage Last? 40 Celebrated Couples Share with Us the Secrets of a Happy Life. Phil Donahue and Marlo Thomas were themselves approaching their 40th wedding anniversary at the time that they wrote this book. In preparing it, they sat down with a number of noteworthy couples who had had long and successful marriages to explore just what was behind those marriages and their health. They spoke with a wide range of people, and just a partial list includes former President Jimmy Carter and his wife Rosalynn Carter. They spoke with James Carville and Mary Matalin, with Billy and Janice Crystal, with Viola Davis and Julius Tenen, with Ted Danson and Mary Steenburgen, with Neil Patrick Harris and David Burka, with Ron and Cheryl Howard, with Elton John and David Furnish, with Ray and Anna Romano, and on. It's a wonderful book, and I was thrilled to have the opportunity to record this brief conversation with them. Marlo Thomas and Phil Donahue, we welcome you to the morning show. The two of you are about to celebrate your 40th wedding anniversary. Congratulations. A lot of people who have had a long, successful marriage would decide to write a book on how to have a successful marriage, just drawing from their own experience. You clearly made a different decision to look at the stories of many other long-term married couples. What inspired you to do that?
I think we're experts on marriage, and one marriage doesn't tell the story anyway. It takes a lot of knowledge, a lot of wisdom, a lot of information to get to the truth. So by interviewing 40 different couples, we found out what makes a marriage work. It isn't how to make it work, but what is it? What is it that goes on that makes a marriage work? What are all the challenges? And every single couple, a different challenge, right, honey?
Really. And certainly, well, something we probably knew but doesn't really come to the forefront of the brain. There's no such thing as a marriage that has no alleys, that has no
challenges
or big drops, big. Everybody has to face something. And I think it's a healthy thing for newlyweds to at least know this, not dwell on it, but anticipate it, not be bored by it.
And not be scared by it. And that's something that couples that have been married 20, 30 years as well, when confronted with, for example, Kira Sedgwick and Kevin Bacon, they lost the 30 years of their savings to Bernie Madoff. And her stepfather was the one that got them into it. And he didn't blame her, and she didn't blame the stepfather. It was something they did. They thought it was a good idea. They were making money, and all of a sudden, they lost everything. It was very interesting to see that if they had played the blame game, they probably would have separated. But they didn't. They just confronted it and said, okay, you know what? We were stupid. We don't know anything about money. We're actors. What do we know? We made a mistake. Move on.
Right.
And I think that feeling that let's move on together, let's go through the fire together, is what has kept these marriages together with every kind of challenge. And no marriage gets by with only one challenge. There's many, many challenges through the years. You know, Michael J. Fox and Tracy Pollan, within 3 years of their marriage, he was diagnosed with a lifelong disease that would certainly challenge them and their family. And Jesse Jackson, during his marriage, had a child with another woman out of wedlock, and Jackie had to face that. Oh, honey, tell Greg what Jackie Jackson said.
Well, first of all, she refers to her husband as the Reverend, mm-hmm. And when people ask her how many children she has, She said, well, I have five. The Reverend has six.
She's really a spitfire. But again, it's her humor. It's her willingness to be candid and face the truth. We didn't bring that up to her. She brought it up as a challenge of her marriage. It's just, you know, in many, much alcoholism and cocaine abuse. Jamie Lee Curtis dealt with that with her husband, Chris Guest.
And jealousy, and how draining that is.
Hmm. And also, Mark Consuelos, Kelly Ripa's husband, thought she was not telling him the truth. He was in Boston making a movie, and he asked her what she was doing that night in New York, and she said, I'm cleaning the toilets. He hopped on a plane.
He thought that was very fishy.
Very fishy. So he hopped on a plane and went back to New York to try to catch her, and there she was, cleaning the toilets.
Right. He walked right past her looking for a tall, dark stranger standing behind a drapery. So, I mean, it's what jealousy can do to you if you let it.
And it's also the constant, you know, you're not the same people. And Judy Vioris, who's a wonderful writer, said, you know, no matter how hard you try, he's never going to become you, and you're never going to become him. Really have to face that and make the accommodations necessary for this other person who is completely different from you.
Right, exactly. That's such good advice. The whole book's packed with it, of course. I like Viola Davis's line that marriage isn't 50-50, it's 100-100, and I think it speaks to what you were talking about. President Carter and his wife Rosalind are probably your most distinguished guests, 74 years married. They talk in their conversation with you about how difficult they had writing a book together, and here you are writing a book together. What has this experience been like for the two of you to embark on this project together?
Than I ever knew before. I mean, really, I've had a front row seat watching. If you're going to be quarantined, you could do worse than be locked up with Marlo. She's fun to be with, and she's always does little things like, you know, popcorn for the movie that she wants to watch tonight. So, you know, and I'm looking for more news on cable TV.
That's what we fight about the most, is watching the news all day. But I think what Greg was asking was, what was it like for us to work on a book together? And I think it was interesting. We never wanted to work on a project together. We were always afraid that we wouldn't get along because I'm kind of bossy and he's kind of bossy. So we thought, uh-oh. We're two type A personalities and we just never wanted to do it. And when we decided to do this book together, we decided to plunge right in. We figured after 40 years, we probably could do it. And what we found interesting that I guess we hadn't really put together is that our styles are so different, the way we approach a problem or an issue. He's very cool and very laid back, and I'm much more excitable and much more, you know, we got to fix this, we got to do this. A perfect example of that is we was going to interview Elton John and David Furnish in Toronto. We traveled all over the country, actually, to do this book because we insisted on doing everybody in person. And a little bit before the interview with Elton John and David Furnish, the assistant told us we had a half hour. Well, I went into panic mode. I thought, oh, my God, a half hour. So I started making up questions. It would be rapid-fire questions. And Phil sat down and put the sports on, the news on television. And I said, what are you doing? We have to get organized here. And we're only going to have a half hour when we usually had 2 or 2.5 hours with people. And we never prepared questions, but this one I figured we better get rapid questions so we'll get everything in a half hour. And he said to me, oh, don't worry about it. He said, they're not going to stop after a half hour. Well, I thought he was crazy. So I got completely organized and ready, and we went up there, and we were there 2 hours. He's right. You know, he doesn't go into panic mode. I go into panic mode. But and then a way that helps. I mean, if we both got excited, that wouldn't be any good.
Right.
And if we were both laid back, we wouldn't be prepared in case something happened. So the differences in our personalities were not a hindrance. They really worked.
Mm. And that's actually a theme that's very much throughout this book, how sometimes opposites attract, and it's sometimes the differences between us that make a marriage most work. A last quick question. Were people ever reluctant to share these kind of things with you, or were they eager and excited to be open about this part of their lives?
I think a little of both. They started out, you know, when we got the transcript back from our taping and we looked at the transcript, you could see there was a moment where everybody clicked in. You know, at the beginning.
At first, they really looked us over.
Yeah, they did.
You know, what's going on here? and we understood that.
Yeah.
But once we got started.
Then it got to be fun.
It did. And we looked up and we realized that we were there for at least 2 hours.
And the funny thing is Mr. Donahue here said to me before we started, he said, "I'm not talking about our marriage." And I said, "Okay." But, of course, we did the whole time, because when you sit down on a double date, two couples talking, it comes out. He was really floored when we would get back the transcripts. He said, "Oh, my God, I didn't realize I said that." So it was so friendly that I really was like a double date.
Mm. Well, the book, again, titled What Makes a Marriage Last, 40 Celebrated Couples Share With Us the Secrets to a Happy Life, is a delight, start to finish. Marlo Thomas, Phil Donahue, thanks for giving the world this wonderful book, and happy 40th anniversary to you both.
Thanks, Greg.
Thank you.
Best wishes. Phil Donahue died yesterday at the age of 88. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and here's part three.
We are going to learn something about the great city of New York City today on the morning show from James Traeger, who is responsible for a fascinating book called The New York Chronology, the ultimate compendium of events, people, and anecdotes from the Dutch to the present. James Traeger is responsible for several different books, and they are all chronologies of one kind or another, examining world history, culinary history, and women's history. And he has also written about New York City in the past, and he lives in Manhattan now and has so for more than half a century. We're really grateful that James Traeger can join us for a few minutes to talk about this book and his love of New York City. James Traeger, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you.
Tell us, first of all, how you got into this particular area of writing chronologies and of approaching various historical topics through the medium of the chronology.
Well, some people seem to think history happened alphabetically, so they write encyclopedias, but it occurred to me rather early that history happened year by year. And so back in the 70s, I got this idea. Somebody said that history is an arrangement of fact. So this book is arranged. The other chronologies are all arranged with graphic symbols. This one has 32 different graphic symbols. So if you're interested in the theater or music or sports or finance or restaurants or whatever, you get end of the year, and there's an alphabetical index in the back, but there's also this way of getting into a year, seeing all the things that happened that year, and where you look at where you arrange facts alphabetically, you don't get that sense of what else is happening.
This book is big, over 900 pages, and I suppose part of that is because you've tackled a big topic with New York City and its long history, which stretches into the 16th century, as a matter of fact. How did you go about culling all of this information and then putting it into some order? What was the process for you?
Well, it's a matter of accretion, I guess, that you start with what you have from the previous chronologies. There was always a certain amount of New York information in the other chronologies. You combine those, you end up throwing away a lot of them, and then you think, well, you really have to have all the mayors of New York. You really have to have all the governors. You really have to have the major buildings. Not just, you can't just talk about Manhattan. You have to talk about Brooklyn and the Bronx and Staten Island and Queens. And it's a bit like being a detective, which is kind of tedious work. It's not like it is in the movies. You really just have to, you know, track down the details on each subject, and it involves a lot of use of the microfilm in the library, because
one thing that, of course, springs up, especially around a city that just is as exciting and charismatic as New York City, is a certain amount of folklore and mythology. To what extent have you tried to grapple with some of that? Or can we take everything that we find in the pages of your chronology as absolute fact that we are certain, in fact, occurred?
I think there may be some places where I say that things are, you know, nobody is really absolutely sure about the details of the transaction where Peter Minuit supposedly traded $24 million worth, $24, not million, just $24 worth of whatever to the Indians for Manhattan Island. It explains why the information is sketchy. And the Indians, of course, didn't own the island, and they thought they were just leasing it, not selling it outright. Virtually all of it is very well documented and accurate, with very precise dates. I mean, I will give you the precise date that every legitimate theater in Broadway, in the Broadway area, opened, and I'll give you the date that Guys and Dolls opened, at what theater, who was in it, what the songs were, who wrote them, how many performances it ran, that sort of thing. It's very detailed.
You've lived in New York City for over 50 years, so
yeah.
Surely over that time, especially someone who is obviously very interested in history and written about it, you surely had gone out of your way to pick up a lot of history along the way. What would you say, however, would be the kind of things which you really learned about your longtime home for the first time through the course of researching this book, being particularly interesting things that you had not known about New York City before?
Well, you know, even at the time that we're living, things are happening that we're so engrossed in our own lives that we don't really realize how significant they are until you look back and you see all of the corruption that went on in the police department, which has affected the mayoralty. But there were so many interesting characters in New York. People who, you know, good guys and bad guys, famous people and not so famous, people who should be more famous, people like Wilson Meisner. Most people never heard of Wilson Meisner, but Wilson Meisner, his brother Addison Meisner, is probably better known because he designed a lot of the Palm Beach mansions that are kind of goofy with doors that open onto brick walls and staircases that didn't lead anywhere. But both of these brothers, they came from Benicia, California. They went up to the Yukon or the Klondike at the turn of the last century. And with Tex Rickard, who built the first Madison Square Garden, or not the first one, but the one that was torn down on 8th Avenue to make way for the present monstrosity. At the time that they tore down Penn Station, they put up a new Madison Square Garden. But Wilson Meisner was a prize fight manager who became a playwright on Broadway, very successful. Wound up as a screenwriter in Hollywood. He used to say that if you steal from one source, that's plagiarism, and if you steal from a lot of sources, that's research. Well, that's what I do. I steal from a lot of sources, and so I don't plagiarize because you're not. Can't make up this stuff. You have to find it somewhere.
One of the things that's probably especially helpful to many of us that don't know very much about the early history of New York City, I imagine there are a whole lot of even present-day residents of New York City that don't necessarily know much about its earliest days, is the fact that really the New York City in its early days was a Dutch community. In fact, for a time, wasn't it called New Amsterdam?
It was a fur trading post. That was the original attraction.
What do you think was particularly significant about the fact that, that it was the Dutch who settled New York City? I mean, did they leave some sort of imprint which has helped give it the character that it has in its subsequent history, would you say?
There's very little left. There are some names of streets that are Dutch. There's a Dutch Reformed Church. That's about it. Of course, there's a lot of literature that goes back to the references to the Dutch. I mean, Washington Irving, who was not Dutch, wrote a lot about the Dutch. You know, Christmas is coming, and a lot of and the Dutch, I guess, celebrated Christmas, but Puritans did not. And the Santa Claus, really, as we think of him today, started out in New York. But, you know, think of Clement Clark Moore and the visit from St. Nicholas, and you think of Thomas Nast cartoons, and, of course, Washington Irving started it with his descriptions.
Something else has its roots in New York City, in a sense. One of the things you mentioned, again, back in its early history of the year, 1644, you mentioned that the first American Emancipation Proclamation occurred in New York City when 11 blacks are set free from their servitude. You list that as the first time on the North American continent that there were black slaves set free. That's a little interesting footnote in history that I knew nothing about till I read your book.
Yeah, but we had slavery in New York until I think the 1820s. It doesn't have a perfect record of emancipation. That was...
You also mentioned the fact that for a time, New York City, one out of four structures is a tavern. Clearly, this was not the most pristine of communities, especially in its early going.
Well, the whole country was a heavy drinking country back in the early days. People put away incredible amounts of alcohol.
What is your sense of where you might go from here? Because I should think that a chronology that captures the bustling life and fascinating history of New York City, it's kind of a tough act to follow, but do you already think about other chronologies that you might write?
I have one in the wings, but I'm not talking about it. It's not related to New York specifically.
Well, this particular book certainly gives us a wonderful insight into the rich history of New York City, a city which clearly you feel a great deal of affection. The book is called The New York Chronology, The Ultimate Compendium of Events, People, and Anecdotes from the Dutch to the Present. It's published by Harper Resource. James Traeger, the author. James Traeger, a pleasure speaking with you today on The Morning Show.
Thank you.
The preceding interview was recorded and initially broadcast way back in 2003. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Diana McLean Smith, author of Remaking the Space Between Us, How Citizens Can Work Together to Build a Better Future for All. It's really a book about how we can communicate across the bitter political divide that we find in our country right now. On Thursday, Dr. Art Sear joins us for his monthly visit to the program. On Friday, sports writer Ian O'Connor and his fascinating book called Out of the Darkness, The Mystery of Aaron Rodgers. Aaron Rodgers, of course, the former quarterback of the Green Bay Packers. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You'll find The Morning Show archive on our website, WGTD.org. It looks like the weather forecast for this coming week is for very, very pleasant conditions, with mostly clear skies and very comfortable temperatures over the next several days. Today's high 72, tomorrow's high 76, Thursday's high 79, Friday's high 83. We do get a bit hot over the weekend, 86 on Saturday, close to 90 degrees for a high on Sunday and Monday. This is WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.